Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the closing session of the Equinox Summit, Energy 2030 from the Waterloo Global Science Initiative, a partnership between Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics and the University of Waterloo. My name is John Matlock, WGSI Executive Producer, and it's my pleasure to welcome the many guests in our audience today, members from the federal and provincial governments, members from business, academia, and beyond, as well as a welcome to our WGSI board members who are here today, Dr. Arthur Carty, Dr. Tom Berstofsky, Michael Duchenne, our board chair and vice chair we'll hear from shortly, and to our advisory committee member, Dr. Calvin Stiller, who's here.
My name is Julie Wright, and I am the WGSI coordinator and your fellow master of ceremonies for today's event. This session is coming to you in theater and online in partnership with TVO from Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. And I just want to take this moment to remind you that if you do have a mobile device with you in the theater, please take a moment to turn it off. And if you are planning on taking photos, to make sure that your flash is turned off. The purpose of the Equinox Summit has been to help reboot the global dialogue on energy issues, particularly involving a growing need for electricity. The summit has aimed to do so by benchmarking our capability to generate electricity, showing present and future needs, by examining scientific and technological ideas with the potential for transformative change, and by shortlisting some of the best approaches and implementation steps if we are to make progress in the next 20 years and begin to realize a cleaner, more electrified future.
Now, as you'll see in the video, rebooting the dialogue has been taking place in partnership with TVO through these live webcasts, on-demand viewing, television broadcasts. There will also be future rebroadcasts and podcasts of some sessions. Much of this content will remain available on TVO.org as well as the WGSI.org website to be enjoyed, viewed, and shared in the future. Benchmarking of our present and future needs has also started to take place. We, in fact, began this summit with the Equinox benchmark videos, and these have helped catalyze the discussions these last several days. And we've also had several days of public lectures, panel discussions, and behind-the-closed-door sessions where various ideas were examined in private from additional scientific and implementation points of view.
At the heart of this summit are three very important groups of people who have collaborated on technological approaches and implementation strategies to realize a more electrified future. They include the Quorum of Scientific Experts, who told us about R&D developments, the Forum of Young International Leaders in politics, policy, academia, and civil society, and business, and nine advisors who helped all of the participants work toward their R&D and implementation strategies this week. You can learn more about the structure of the summit and all of the participants by visiting WGSI.org.
So we've been delivering on the aims of this summit the last few days. Today's session will focus on that last point, which is the findings so far with the unveiling of the WGSI Equinox Summit Communique, which is now available online. And in this session, we will share some reference points from where the summit began and transport you to where the thinking has evolved over the last few days. And what you see and learn today will be highlights with many more details to come in the future Equinox blueprint. After these communique highlights, we will close on some final thoughts from our vice chair and board chair from WGSI. Now, to begin our exploration of the summit's early findings, we turn to our moderator, Wilson De Silva. Wilson is co-founder and editor-in-chief at Cosmos magazine. He is also past president of the World Federation of Science Journalists, the leading international body that links together all of the world's science writing organizations. He has been a part of the Equinox Summit from inception, having been the head of our content team and the moderator throughout these last several days. Wilson's job is to make the communique and all the information here as accessible as possible. So with that, over to Wilson De Silva.
Thank you very much, John. Thank you, John and Julie, and thank you to everyone who has made Equinox Summit Energy 2030, the success it has turned out to be. We're very, very proud of where we've got to. Ladies and gentlemen, as we've learnt throughout the conference, the summit, that we face enormous challenges in the decades ahead. And climate change is a diabolical problem. It's not going to be solved easily, and it's not going to be solved quickly. But we are very talented species. We have mastery of the planet like never before. Never before in human history have we been able to do what we can do these days. And it's to address the costs that our success has generated that we have gathered here to try and tap the scientific and technological civilization to meet them, meet those challenges. And to begin, though, let's recap the problem. Let's look at the trouble with carbon and what it is that we had to face. If we could play the video, please.
It's everywhere. You see it on the news, in your newspaper, on the net. We're running out of oil. The use of coal and oil is at its highest peak in history. Energy prices are going through the stratosphere. We are dependent on non-renewable fossil fuels, what some call high carbon energy. And at the rate and way we're using energy, that might lead to irreversible damage. A global crisis is coming. What will we do? Will factories go silent? Homes dark? Economies grind to a halt? The world in chaos? Terra incognita? Or is there a map we can follow? Life on Earth has always emitted carbon dioxide, also known as CO2. We all exhale CO2. It's a natural component of the atmosphere, used by plants in photosynthesis to grow and thrive. Photosynthesis is driven by the sun, and the sun's light inspired us to create and control our own illumination, eventually creating the electric light bulb, which we powered by burning coal. We transformed our world with all those bulbs and the other electrical devices that followed. In addition to coal, we burned other fossil fuels, like oil and natural gas, which produced a lot more CO2 than our planet can use and greatly increased our carbon footprint on the globe. CO2 in the atmosphere is measured in parts per million. But what does that mean when we can't actually see it? Imagine the carbon dioxide gas as a solid. Think of soot. Each year, we're emitting 8 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide. If that were soot, we could fill up about 1 million rail cars. Since the Industrial Revolution, we could have filled 430 million rail cars, enough to circle the Earth 190 times. Today, the CO2 in the atmosphere is like a thick blanket around the Earth. And as the blanket grows heavier, the planet gets sicker. The symptoms are always in the news. Violent storms, floods, droughts and fires, melting ice caps and glaciers. 350 parts per million is the accepted carbon blanket in the atmosphere that would keep the planet livable for the human race. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, we were at 289 parts per million. By 2011, it grew to around 392 parts per million. In 2030, some predict we will exceed 450 parts per million. Experts say we face catastrophic losses for every living thing on Earth because our reliance on high carbon energy is jeopardizing our future. Plus, our population is set to grow to 9 billion by the year 2050. There are already 7 billion people on the planet today, and 1.5 billion of them don't have access to modern electricity, but want it. So, if we're to satisfy present and future energy demands and ensure our ability to thrive on planet Earth, we must examine cleaner and more efficient ways for the generation, distribution, and storage of electricity.
Well, that's the overview. Energy supply makes the largest contribution to greenhouse gas emissions, which is why we focused on energy, in particular the generation, distribution, and storage of electricity. Why electricity? Because the world is becoming increasingly electrified. Electricity is the fastest growing form of end-use energy consumption, forecast to outpace the growth in other forms of energy demand in the decades ahead. But first, to give you an insight how we try to tackle this problem, let me explain to you the process of the Equinox Summit. It consists of three core groups: the Quorum, Advisors, and the Forum. The Quorum is a group of scientists and engineers who have showcased innovative technologies or systems approaches with the potential to transform our electricity system and have a meaningful contribution to our reduction on emissions globally. The Forum is made up of future leaders from around the world, people aged 20 to 30 from many walks of life, public policy, community action, government, industry, and academia. They have worked with the Quorum, drawing on their technical expertise to craft a range of proposals and pathways to address this urgent issue. There are also the Advisors, senior people from industry, science, technology, and industry, who have provided a critical analysis of the technologies and concepts discussed. What we saw this week was open, candid, cross-disciplinary, and multi-generational dialogue that bore fruit. But first, let's identify the nature of the challenge we faced when we started this. I'm going to hand over to Jatin Natwani, who I'll introduce first. He's been our Summit Scientific Advisor to the facilitation team. He's the Ontario Research Chair in Public Policy and Sustainable Energy Management, a professor at the University of Waterloo, and Executive Director of the Waterloo Institute for Sustainable Energy. Jatin.
Thank you, Wilson. Let me share with you the magnitude of the energy challenge. Today's global energy consumption is 16.5 terawatts, of which 2.5 is non-carbon, essentially hydro, nuclear, some renewables. By 2050, this will rise to 30 terawatts, most likely higher than that, but this is the base case. If 50% of the global energy demand in 2050 were to be met by non-carbon sources of energy, that is a requirement of 15 terawatts of new, renewable, non-carbon forms of energy. That to meet the stabilization limit of 550 parts per million of greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere. That is a six-fold increase from today's renewable energy global capacity. Also, that is equivalent to today's total energy global consumption. In simple terms, all new growth to be met will have to be non-carbon sources of energy. Here I would like to draw your attention to the participants from each of the countries by their flags. At this summit, the major theme of discussions has been around generation, distribution, and storage, its use and integration. The technologies that we discussed included nuclear, geothermal, renewables, and large-scale storage, superconductors, flexible solar, batteries, smart grid, and so on. We have a comprehensive global perspective. We believe that is required and is necessary to meet the societal needs to decarbonize our economy, to improve efficiency, improve access and security. At this summit, three themes have emerged, and they cluster around rural electrification needs, urbanization, and electrification of the transport sector. Now, if I were to do a traditional matrix, you would see a very complicated picture here, but that's not so helpful. Instead, we have a way to share our story in a different way. And Jason will now describe the low-carbon electricity ecosystem.
But first, let me introduce you to Jason. He is Jason Blackstock, is a Summit's former peer advisor. And he's a senior fellow for energy and environment at the Center for International Governance and Innovation in Waterloo.
Thank you, Wilson. Thank you, Jatin. What you see here is, from the incredible conversations that we had, the very dynamic and creative conversations, we took a different way of looking at how the variety of technologies and the variety of issues could come together in a collective ecosystem, a low-carbon electricity ecosystem that could build synergies between these various technologies, between the various challenges that are faced in different parts of the world. What you see up here right now are the four key elements that you're going to hear more about from individual presentations of forum and quorum members in a minute. And we started with base load and went through smart urbanization, electrified transport, and rural electrification. You'll hear more detail as we go along through this. Each of these, though, was not the sort of matrix that Jatin was talking about, but rather integrated systems. How do we pull the best out of all of the different technologies we've heard, integrate them together to create technology-enabled pathways towards the low-carbon vision that we have for the future? The sort of technologies that you'll hear about are going up there now. Each of the forum and quorum partnerships will talk individually to these different technologies as they come up throughout the next presentations. And one of the key messages is about the interconnection between all of these different opportunities to build wealth creation around the world. First, we're going to hear for three presentations that are going to relate to baseload electricity production. Now, what does this mean? We're used to flicking a light switch and having that light come on immediately. We're used in the developing world to having electricity on demand, but that means it needs to be there when we flick the light switch, which means we have to keep running in the background some production of electricity to be there when we need it. That's the basic idea of baseload. Now, at the moment, a very large component of our baseload electricity comes from fossil fuels. The three presentations you're about to hear on ideas for a nuclear future, for geothermal and renewables enabled through large-scale storage are ways to decarbonize this baseload electricity production. First, we're going to hear about the potential nuclear future from Jacob Nygaard, a member of the Forum from Denmark, and Yassine Kadi, a member of the Quorum, who's a project leader at CERN over in Europe. Gentlemen, over to you.
Thank you, Jason. And thank you all here in the room and at home for taking an interest in our energy future. We're here to provide you with the first piece of the puzzle. Nuclear waste can fuel our energy future. Nuclear energy can be clean, it can be safe, and it can be sustainable. In other words, we're here to challenge the general assumptions about the future of nuclear energy. Now, we're not oblivious to the world we live in. Advancing nuclear energy in today's world is not an easy sell. But the allure of these technologies is simply too great to ignore. For one thing, nuclear waste is the fuel source. The need for long-term storage of waste becomes irrelevant. And further, it allows us to eliminate the world's currently accumulated stockpiles of nuclear waste. This, by the way, provides an opportunity to draw funding from nuclear waste management funds. Secondly, and related to that point, it closes the nuclear fuel cycle. Nuclear becomes sustainable, and for all intents and purposes, inexhaustible. Third, they address the risks of nuclear energy. The design incorporates passive safety measures. In other words, the safety measures rely on the basic laws of physics. That is to say, they don't rely on a backup generator. And fourth, and perhaps most importantly, they decarbonize our electricity baseload. If we are serious about getting off coal, we will need an alternative, and these technologies, these advanced technologies, provide that alternative. And the technologies I'm talking about, well, there are a number of technologies ready for large-scale deployment. Some are more promising than others. Our discussions this week has led us to the conclusion that the two most promising technologies by far are the integral fast reactor and the accelerated thorium-driven system. And here to tell you more about this and how we get there is Yasin Kadi.
Thank you, Jacob. Thank you. So I'd like to basically expand a little bit on what Jacob has illustrated to you previously. So today, about 400 gigawatt electric is produced with the help of about 450 reactors which have been installed, corresponding to about 14% of the total electricity generated in the world. At best, we can expand this nuclear power output to double, to about 800 gigawatt, and mostly in order to cope with the energy demand, electricity demand, basically in China and India alone. Having said that, the main issues still remain to be solved as far as nuclear power, deployment of nuclear power is concerned, and these were listed by Jacob earlier on. So that is nuclear waste generation, nuclear safety, proliferations, and the availability of the resources. If we were to imagine deploying at a larger scale nuclear power in the world in order to meet the demand for a decarbonization of the electrical generation, then something serious would have to be done today, starting today. The most important aspect, I think, would be first closing the nuclear fuel cycle. This will give us the opportunity to recycle, not only to recycle the nuclear waste which will be generated, but also to recycle the nuclear waste which we have been generating for the last 40 to 50 years. This will also give us an opportunity to use more efficiently our natural resources. Namely, we know that we don't have, extended availability of uranium resources in the world. So how do we go about this? Several technologies are being developed today which can fulfill or meet at least some of the requirements for the extending use of the nuclear energy today. And I would like to basically dwell on two of these which have been illustrated or mentioned by Jacob. One is the integral fast reactor design, and the other one is the thorium accelerator driven reactor design. The first technology, the integral fast reactor design, relies on closing the uranium-plutonium fuel cycle, providing thus an ability to evolve from the current nuclear technology that we have today to a more developed technology which can be deployed in a rather short to medium term. The thorium accelerator-driven design is a revolutionary design in the sense that it opens us the opportunity to address completely differently the way we perceive nuclear power, the way we design nuclear reactors today. And this is by coupling accelerator technology, nuclear reactor technology, and thorium fuel technology. This would, in a medium to longer term, if deployed, enable us to really envisage a large deployment of nuclear reactor, not only in developed countries, but also in developing countries. Now, how do we go about this? Well, the idea that was discussed in this summit is basically to try to produce or develop an initiative, a multilateral initiatives, which could accelerate the research and development of these two technologies in order to bring them to the demonstration phase in the next 10 to 20 years. Several countries in the world are interested or have their own small-scale programs in order to meet that challenges. But I think we have a very good example in the world today of such an initiative which has led to the development or to the putting in place such a demonstrator, and this is what we call here the ITER project. This is the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor. This is an initiative which has been put together in order to build by the year 2030 a fusion reactor demonstration. I think we could do with a very similar approach, manage to have such a demonstration for the IFR and the thorium ADS in the next 20 to 30 years. Thank you very much.
Jacob and Yasin, thank you. So the potential of nuclear was certainly explored, but as we all know, there's not one silver bullet solution. In terms of dealing with baseload power, we also talked quite a bit at the summit about the potential of geothermal, and here to talk to us about that is Foreign Member Laura Rigga from the United States and Quorum Member Robin Batterham, the former Chief Scientist of Australia. Lauren and Robin, please.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us. Geopower has the potential to transform global energy development and help replace coal as the major source of baseload power. Geopower is already commercialized and currently provides 10 gigawatts of energy all over the world. In order to reach terawatt scale, we need to dig deeper. A lot of drilling technology already exists, but more work is needed to de-risk the technology at production scale. The way to do that is through a series of significant international demonstration projects. With your help, we are interested in facilitating a meeting to initiate an international collaboration of industry and government to enable the scale-up of this technology. The intended outputs of this meeting would enable us to map geological resources, as well as identify and build a series of large-scale projects with a total cost of $1 billion that will deliver certainty about the exploration of techniques, confidence on production costs, and ultimately de-risk the technology so that commercial projects are fundable. Finally, I would like to emphasize that geothermal power is clean and inexhaustible. It will never run out. And despite the large upfront costs, we expect geothermal energy will have the lowest long-term cost per megawatt than any other energy source, even coal. This is the sort of innovation that's not just good for energy, it seeds a whole new industry. Right, Robin?
Sounds good. Lauren, thank you for that. I've had the great pleasure of doing a review for the Australian government on geothermal. And Australian government has got this opinion that 50% of baseload power could come from geothermal by 2050. That's an awful lot of power. And they're a bit worried that the industry investment and uptake in this area wasn't going fast enough. So they've put a few incentives on the table. And my pleasant task was to listen to the industry, look at the science, and understand what's the rate of uptake and is it happening fast enough. Now, the key question to me is, why isn't geothermal happening faster? You've got 10 gigawatts already. Geothermal heating, of course, has been around since prehistoric times. The Romans certainly enjoyed it, and we've been generating power from it for quite some time. So why isn't it happening faster? Well, the answer is fairly simple. The larger and more extensive resources are very deep. They're 3 to 4 kilometres, or even, dare I say, in this province, 5 kilometres possibly deep. That's a long way to go down. The oil and gas industry has a lot of experience in that area, but drilling for geothermal is a bit different. Until you get down there, you don't really know what the temperature is. And until you drill a couple of wells, you don't know how much you can flow between them. So add all that lot up, and it says in terms of commercial propositions, this technology still needs some de-risking. So it's really about de-risking at scale. And as Lauren has indicated to you, if you get this right, the prize is great, and it actually isn't that much of a challenge to see if we can get it right. What's needed is, in fact, of order 10 large-scale projects to demonstrate what the real risks are. Nobody likes to be first with major investments. You like to be able to go and put your hand on the generator and hear or feel it that it is really running. So how do you get to that stage? That's our suggestion. 10 large projects to de-risk the technology and accelerate commercial investment. That could happen fairly quickly. And I'd suggest that's the discussion. It needs, some initiative, perhaps on the part of the Canadian government, perhaps even with this Perimeter Institute, to step up and organise the global initiative that's needed. It is happening in places. The picture you see there, and I'll finish with two places where it's happening one way or another. That's at Dürrenhaar in the south of Bavaria. It's the Bavarian Electric Light Company, for want of a better term, who have put 35 million euros into it. They expect to be generating 5 megawatts and delivering it to 18,000 homes by January next year. That's not far off. That's real work happening. But we need a lot more of that. I'll leave you with a teaser. Google has just invested in a deep drilling company with a new innovative approach that's going to get the drilling costs for geothermal down. Now, why would Google want to put their money into geothermal? You can sort that one out.
Lauren and Robin, thank you very much. So with advanced nuclear technologies and geothermal, you're hearing technologies that you probably haven't come across nearly as much. Some technologies that you're very familiar with for energy production are wind and solar, the sort of renewable technologies that we're used to seeing everywhere. But in order to enable them to provide baseload rather than variable power, you need large-scale storage to integrate with it. Here to talk to you about this is forum member Zoe Karen from here in Canada and Maria Skelos-Kazakos from the University of New South Wales, a quorum member. Zoe and Maria, please.
Thank you, Jason. So a friend and I were at a UN climate change conference in Denmark a few years ago, and one night after late meetings, we were walking by a huge Lego storefront, and they have a wind turbine toy set now, and it comes with the turbine, and it comes with a transport truck, and a fence that goes all around it, and a little Lego man that sets it up, and a transmission line, and it's very cute. And at that moment, when we were looking at it, very impressed, my friend turned to me and just said, "Battery pack not included." And it's interesting because many of us don't really realize that we now actually do have the power to make wind and solar a completely reliable source of electricity via large-scale battery storage. So I'm just going to take you through a bit of the potential that we're looking at when we think of renewable energy in the big picture, first of all. These are from the World Wildlife Fund's energy report. If 0.3% of the Sahara Desert was a concentrated solar plant, it would power all of Europe. You look at ocean energy, 0.1% meet the needs of 15 billion people. This is massive scale, and there are many different types of renewable energy. But just to give you a sense of what we're looking at here, the light green circles that you see on the screen is renewable energy potential. The dark green is fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas. And as you can see, almost everywhere in the world, with the exception of the Middle East, there is a massive amount of renewable energy available. Now, why are we only then up to 13% for our world energy resources? What I'm going to do is delve into the electricity portion of this. So looking at particularly where we are in terms of large-scale deployment of renewable electricity, you just heard about geothermal. The major issue that we're looking at is that we can't store the energy. The sun only shines during the day. The wind only blows when it wants to. Last night here in Kitchener, I don't know if you woke up at 3 a.m., but the winds were very strong. This can be addressed by implementing large-scale storage. And let's just think about what this would look like in actual implementation in terms of the benefits. So think of, let's say, an island economy. Let's think of Hawaii, maybe Maui, where you have wind power already installed, but you also have imported diesel. You could very easily install a large-scale battery there where you capture wind energy during the day, perhaps some excess, and then dispatch it during the evening when needed and actually help you get off diesel. Even here in Ontario, it could be applied. The government here is really investing a lot in renewable energy, and that could actually help move that forward and help that renewable energy actually become more reliable. So these batteries exist. Why aren't we using them more large scale? This is the miracle question. Essentially, the batteries have not penetrated the market yet. They are being manufactured. Three places that they're being created in are China, Austria, the United States. They obviously see that there's some innovation and wealth potential here as they're investing in them. In terms of where they are currently about to be deployed or are being deployed already, two power plants in Japan, one power plant in the United States. So when we think about where we're heading on this and how to get into this large-scale development, doing maybe, let's say, 3 large-scale demonstration projects would really start pushing this forward into and towards commercialization of these batteries. It could be in China. They're already looking into it. It could be in Germany, who has committed to phase out nuclear, and now they've committed to a high level of renewable. There would be interest there. And maybe there's interest in Canada. The mineral that you need for these batteries exists here. We have renewable energy leadership already in the country, and there's a huge renewable energy potential, as you saw in North America. So I will leave you with that, and I will now pass it on to Maria, who I've had the pleasure of working with and who has actually developed one of these large-scale storage batteries.
Thank you, Zoe. So we've already seen that we need to move away from carbon in the future, and we need to have a very robust, reliable generation system. But and I don't believe that anyone here believes that only that one single generation technology will be the solution for the future. So in fact, we need to look towards a carbon-free economy and a carbon-free grid that incorporates a wide range of technologies. So we could still be having there could be wind, there could be geothermal, there could be photovoltaics and even nuclear. But in order to bring all of these together, we need to have a reliable storage system that will in fact act as the glue to provide this continuous and reliable power for the carbon-free grid. So storage is very important. There's a range of different storage technologies that have been developed, under development. They all provide different types of technical benefits. Some of the technologies can provide very large-scale, long-duration energy storage, for example, pumped hydro, compressed air technologies. Some of these are very specific to certain geographical locations, so we can't really site them anywhere we like. But on the other hand, batteries are flexible and they can be sited either at the source, at the wind farm, at the power station, or even close, even in residential areas where they could even serve as a backup power in the event that the grid, that the transmission lines fail. So batteries are very, very important, also because they provide very high energy efficiency. Up to 70, 80% of the energy that we put in, we can recover out. So that's why batteries are extremely important. Now, one type of battery that has received in recent years a lot of attention is the flow battery. And we've been working on the vanadium redox flow battery for many years. So it's probably at the most advanced stage of development. And as Zoe has mentioned, that there have been quite a few of these implemented in Japan, in the largest one being a 6-megawatt-hour vanadium battery that was installed on the island of Hokkaido. It has been integrated to a large wind farm, and it was able to demonstrate 200,000 cycles during its demonstration, and 80% efficiency. So the challenge now is to how do we then now put that into production and also meet the cost structure that is essential if we're going to implement it on a large scale. A lot of work has been going on already, and we believe that we've achieved the necessary cost structure, and so hopefully in the future we'll see a lot more of these batteries. But of course this is one step, and further technologies will continue to be developed, and hopefully we'll be able to see a robust, green, carbon-free grid in the near future. Thank you.
Zoe and Maria, thank you very much. So ladies and gentlemen, you've now heard about 3 technology pathways, technology-enabled pathways towards low-carbon production of electricity for our future. But of course, with rising populations and densifying urban cores, it's hard to imagine continuing to expand electricity production ad nauseum until we reach thresholds. We need to be able to also deal with our electricity more efficiently, control the usage that we have. And so one of the things that we focused on was looking at making cities energy smart in those dense urban cores that are going to be growing significantly in the coming decades. And to talk to you more about this, we have forum member Mark MacArthur of Ottawa, Canada, and quorum member Bill Rosehart from the University of Calgary. Over to you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Jason. And hello, everyone. I have a very simple message to convey today, and that is that smart cities provide both an important bridge into the renewable energy future that we've been talking about, as well as a catalyst for change right now. And I hope to be able to convey that to you. So, why smart cities? By 2040, two-thirds of the world's population will live in urban centers with 29 megacities. This is cities consisting of 10 million people or more globally by 2025. That is 6 billion people in urban centers by 2025. Carbon dioxide emissions due to the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning operations of buildings alone account for 17% of total carbon dioxide emissions globally. So what does this look like? This is 7.5 gigatons of carbon dioxide, or equivalent to the carbon dioxide emissions of 1.5 billion cars. To put that in perspective, we've got about 1 billion cars on the road right now. So you can see that even if you can make a 25% improvement, 30% improvement in this number, you would be doing a very, you'd have a very great impact on global carbon dioxide emissions. So how does an intelligent infrastructure and smart cities fit into this? Well, what an intelligent infrastructure and smart cities will allow you to do is to integrate these renewable sources of energy. We've heard of some great ones this week, some really advanced solar, we've talked about wind, but they all come with a variability in their production that everyone is well aware of. But if you have a more responsive infrastructure, it will allow you to match the load with renewables more effectively. But there is one aspect to an intelligent infrastructure that is that even goes beyond control and monitoring, and that is information. It gives us information. So we'd like to propose to you that knowledge is power, and you can actually measure this power in kilowatts. So you can imagine the possibilities of unlocking this data, both in the ability to influence future construction and design in megacities that are yet to be built, as well as influencing behavior right now. Imagine the transformational potential of rewarding customers based on their energy usage with things that they actually want or care about. For example, credit on iTunes, or Netflix, or pizza, or whatever drives you. But the point is, you're making that connection or link between the customer and their energy usage in a way that is directly emotionally and socially related to what they do in everyday life. So could you also imagine the business opportunities and innovative business models that can come out of linking these things that are inherent and connected in an urban infrastructure? So for example, you've got your grid, that's a very big part of our urban infrastructure, but then you also have your social media, your wireless networks, your smartphones. These are all things that are very much related to that urban lifestyle. So again, you can use this data actively right now, or you can use it to, again, influence the future construction. So we have a rough plan of engagement as a forum to when we return to our countries of origin and wherever we're going to say, you know what, we have this need and opportunity to actually look at creating this smart infrastructure, this intelligent infrastructure that will allow us to incorporate these renewable energy technologies that we're looking to have ubiquitous by 2030 and part of our renewable energy future. What we would hope to encourage everyone to do is to help work with us on this. We have the example of the World Bank just recently in Sao Paulo. Their president and CEO signed a memorandum of understanding with the C40. This is the largest, 40 largest, most influential cities globally. And again, this is in recognition of the fact that our global or urban infrastructure and our urban communities have such a large impact on our carbon dioxide emissions. So I'd just like you to remember that intelligent infrastructure is both a bridge to the future, but it's also a catalyst for change now. And with that, I'd like to hand it over to Bill to say a few words about what this looks like in the near term.
Thank you. Often when we speak about carbon and the challenges with carbon, we put a great amount of emphasis on the point source. We talk about coal and we talk about natural gas. But the solutions also lie in how we use our electricity in, to a great effect, urban centers. As we move forward, the solution will involve energy efficiency, distributed generation at our homes, and how and when we use electricity. As an example, we can use our load, our refrigerators, our air conditioners, to mitigate variation with renewable energy, such as solar and wind-based generation. Smart metering in grids can enable this pairing of load with renewables. Right now, governments around the world are in fact incorporating smart meters and smart grid infrastructure. What we need to do is to ensure that this new infrastructure will help enable renewables, not just allow for differential pricing. As Mark correctly pointed out, knowledge is power. To plan for the new paradigm, which we need to transition to in terms of our electrical system, we need to develop a rich understanding of electrical energy usage so that we can take full potential of what the electrical grid can do for us to solve the carbon challenge. Being a global leader in smart grids, like all innovations, will drive a local knowledge-based economy. It is an opportunity. In closing, it's important for us to realize with the growth in cities, with the electrification of transportation, urban electrical demand is likely to increase. To manage this demand sustainably, we will need more efficient buildings. We will need clean distributed generation. And we must control the demand of electricity in our cities wisely to enable renewables. Thank you.
Mark and Bill, thank you. Inside our big cities, it's not only electricity that we use a lot of, it's transportation. To move around currently, we use a tremendous amount of fossil fuels to drive our cars, move our buses. But one of the other issues that we looked at is the trend in urban transportation, particularly electrification of transportation that's coming, which will build electricity demand, but also help clean our cities up and reduce the fossil fuel emissions. To hear about some of the technology and technological pathways, you'll hear now from foreign members Felipe de Leon from Costa Rica and Kerry Chung from the United States. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Jason, and thank you folks here and at home for joining us. Our friends and colleagues have made a very eloquent point and driven a very good vision about how we could be decarbonizing our electricity and making our urban centers more sustainable. However, they've also made the point that 3 billion people will be moving into urban centers by 2030. All these people need to get around somehow, and that's going to look very clearly like that. It's ugly. It's full of smog and full of traffic. Now, let me paint you a different picture. Let me give you a different alternative. How about, rather than wake up in the morning and get in your car, you wake up and check your smartphone, and it will tell you that that all-electric bus that drives by your corner every morning is 6 minutes away, so you can get up, catch it on time, and head out to your office. You'll meet up with your friends for lunch, and you'll have a great carrot cake at lunch with them. When you step out, you'll check your smartphone again, and you'll find that this time the buses are delayed because transit is keeping them up, traffic is keeping them up. Rather than wait, you'll be able to walk out to a shared bicycle hub where you can pick up an electric bicycle, the fastest growing type of electric vehicle in the world right now. That will allow you a leisurely, nice and relaxed bike around town while you run your errands. After that, you can drop off that bike somewhere near an electrical car, which you can of course locate through the smartphone we've been using all along. You can pick up your car, drive home, leave it there and pack in your bags because you're leaving on a trip on the following morning. You'll take the car back to the airport, drop it off for the next possible passenger, get on a plane and go. What does this mean basically for us? It means that individual elements of this system have been put in place all around the world with great success in cities like Paris and Tokyo. Now imagine that driving innovation in cities like Jakarta and San Jose, Costa Rica, where 40% of our emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, are coming from the transportation sector. That is potentially transformational. To tell you a little bit more about the technology that could drive that innovation, here's Kerry Chung.
So throughout the summit, we learned about some several fascinating technologies that can help enable the vision that Felipe had so eloquently painted. I'm referring to the advanced lithium-ion batteries for electric bicycles and electric cars, as well as the vanadium redox flow batteries that can be used for buses and fleet vehicles. Now, lithium-ion batteries are the ones that are currently powering your cell phones and your laptops, while flow batteries might be something new to you. Flow batteries are quite unique since you can quickly recharge them by simply refilling the liquid inside, making it practical for use in hub-to-hub transport such as buses and delivery routes. Now, if we combine the electrification of urban transportation with information and communication technologies, we will accelerate the current trend of increasing the access and sharing of green mobility. Let me reemphasize that the current trend is moving towards increased access and sharing. It's happening today. This shift reflects to our generation's preference to access with less ownership, as can be seen with Netflix, cloud computing, and zip cars. Now, some key challenges associated with this vision are the financing of a pilot demonstration project, the broad social acceptance of this concept, and supportive policies from local institutions. There's also the intellectual property sharing and integration of technology issues. So to illustrate how we would implement this transformative idea, I will use Jakarta, Indonesia as an example with a few action items. We can discuss funding opportunities with the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, and partner with companies like Toyota, BlackBerry, and IBM to help finance a demonstration while simultaneously addressing the IP issues. We can also leverage work from local NGOs such as Green Nation ID to promote social acceptance and to lobby local municipal governments for support. It's important to note that the action items in this table can be tailored to smaller urban centers that will characteristically be different from megacities such as Jakarta. Successful demos in smaller cities will promote the replication and adoption of this concept more globally. In conclusion, there will be an estimated 3 billion extra people living in urban centers by 2030, and they all need some form of transport. There's a key opportunity here to demonstrate the synergistic benefits of integrating electric transport with information and communication technologies to lower greenhouse gas emissions, to reduce congestion, improve air quality, support economic development, and enhance quality of life. We believe that this vision will lead to a cleaner, more sustainable future. Thank you.
Felipe and Carrie, thank you very much. So, ladies and gentlemen, you've now heard about a range of solutions for dealing with situations in the developed world, places where we're used to having electricity and transport at our fingertips. But of course, we talked a lot during this summit about the more than 2 billion people right now living in energy poverty around the world. 2 billion people who don't have access to any forms of modern energy and electricity. And here to tell you about some of the transformational technological pathways that could emerge from the summit are Forum member Aaron Leopold of the United States and Core member Kathy Foley from Australia's National Science Agency, CSIRO. Over to you.
Thank you, Jason. Here today we're going to talk about one of the technologies that we were presented with over the course of this week that seemed to be fit ideally to suit the needs of a very large portion of humanity. That is rural electrification microgrid technology through plastic organic PV combined with magnesium batteries. So we heard the kind of large scale solar or wind plus batteries. Now we're talking about the micro scale. Now, as Jason already mentioned, about 2.5 billion people are currently living without access to modern energy services. This is both an enormous challenge, but also a tremendous social, environmental, and economic opportunity for those people and those who are delivering that technology. So just to give you an overview of the numbers, The dark purple circles are today's date, are today's numbers, and the light purple circles are those of 2030, the target year of this summit. So if you have a look, in Africa alone, 465 million people are currently living without access to modern energy services. That is set to increase to 544 million by 2030. And if you look at the bottom right-hand corner, you've got the dark purple of the total today and the light purple of 2030. It doesn't really seem to be decreasing too much, only by 200 million total. Obviously, we find that unacceptable. So, what is different about this organic plastic PV that we're talking about? It's not the same stuff as we're using today because of two things. It's one, a little bit more expensive per kilowatt hour, but not per unit. The units are much cheaper. The kilowatts are more expensive. That's because they're less efficient. That's what's being worked on right now, of course, hence the R&D funding going on in many universities and companies at the moment to boost that. But at the moment, what we need in the West in these massive utility scale projects is efficiency to bring that cost per kilowatt hour down. However, people without access to these services already pay huge amounts for the energy that they do use, which is traditionally biomass or kerosene, which is very, very expensive in the remote locations in which they're located. So what does this mean? Basically, we have a technology which isn't really practical to be used here, but it's in development nonetheless. And we have millions or billions of dollars of R&D going there because eventually it will become viable here. But in the interim, where can it go? Who's going to use it? Well, it just so happens that it doesn't provide that much electricity, as I stated, but that's exactly the kind of pump priming technology that these people in developing countries need. They need stuff that will turn on lights, that will run communications tools, that will maybe power a refrigerator that can keep vaccinations cold, something that is a huge impediment to the health needs of these people at the moment. So, although this is only one in a suite of possible technologies that would be appropriate, this is the one that was presented to us this week as being most likely to come down in cost quickly and most likely due to its very interesting and attractive properties that would be suitable for the mass dispersal in very, very remote locations. That is, it's flexible. It can be made out of cloth material. You can bend it, fold it, nail it to something, whatever. It's going to work. It's portable. It's literally like cloth in that you can wrap it up, put it in your backpack, and carry it 50 miles down the road. You don't even need a road. That's one of the big problems with getting energy to these people today. It's resilient. It's not going to break. You don't need an engineer to install it. You don't need an engineer to repair it. And when it's lived its life, it's still a piece of cloth. You can use it for something else. The price is also coming down annually. So, oh, actually, I forgot to tell you the examples. So on the left, there it is on a house. And on the right, this is chemical. It's an organic application of this technology that's integrated a light-emitting diode into the cloth. So it's both solar PV and the source of light itself. You can wrap that. This is like a piece of cloth as well. You could wrap it up or do whatever with it. So. Kathy's going to explain to you a bit of the technical side now on kind of the timeline going forward, and then I'm going to jump back in.
Thanks, Aaron. Hi, everyone. As Aaron mentioned, currently silicon cells are flexible, quite the opposite. They're actually rigid and quite expensive, but they're reasonably efficient. They're about 40% efficiency. And to make them, you need fairly large-scale integrated circuit sort of type manufacturing capability, which is not something which is readily available in many companies that are interested in capitalizing on this opportunity. However, plastic or polymer solar cells or photovoltaics are lightweight and flexible and easily deployable. The downside is, though, that they're only about 8.3% efficiency, and that's the best to date so far. However, they can be made from things like the materials that make plastic banknotes or slightly thicker cling wrap, the sort of stuff you wrap up your food in. And if you're able to use a technology which you probably all know really well, and that's the inkjet printer on your desk, and instead of having ink, you have solutions which have nanoparticles in them, instead of red ink, you have semiconductors, and maybe black ink, you have the metallic material, whether it's silver or gold. You're able to create a multiple layers of materials that then lead to these fabulous structures that are able to act as solar cells. To make that sort of thing means that the infrastructure is a lot less than what you need for making the silicon solar cells, and immediately leads to opportunities for small to medium enterprises to set up companies of niche manufacturing, or even could be an opportunity for developing nations to have new manufacturing industries they can exploit. Just to give you an idea of the level of resources needed to do this, if you had 10 tons of plastic, you could produce 10,000 organic photovoltaics. And just to give you an idea of what that means, about the same amount of plastic is needed to make up a whole container load of plastic bags. So by 2014, we believe that these initial systems or structures could be made available commercially. That's not that far away. And in time, about 10 years, we believe that we'll get to a point where the efficiencies are well over 10% and will lead to something which is really cost effective. There's also the opportunity to be able to use them in opportunities such as military applications where their specialized needs are willing to pay higher prices. But because the efficiencies are so are still low, and the cost could potentially be driven down because of the niche manufacturer, there's real opportunities for us to be able to transport these to use in remote areas. Back to you, Aaron.
Thanks, Kathy. So, moving along. This may be the last presentation, but it is certainly not least. It's indeed most. It's talking about affecting a massive amount of people. What we've got here is a goal that by 2030, we will have come a long way in addressing the problem of the energy poverty of these 500 million households. So we're not talking about 2.5 billion customers. 500 million isn't that bad. Now, what we thought of to move towards this goal and to concretely discuss next steps is to devise kind of a who's who in this industry and what's going on where. And we've taken a lot of time to discuss this with the technology developers themselves, along with some policy people who've been here, and have found out that there are a lot of industry players that are spending billions on this. There's civil society organizations in India, such as TERI, with the Light a Billion Lives project, N Plus Co, the Acumen Fund, Oxfam, and these are all NGOs who are working on these issues. Kiva and other microfinance organizations are kind of those who would provide the basic business model to start distributing those technologies on the ground. Now, of course, to get those technologies on the ground, we need to get that price down. The price point is a major limiting factor at this point. Although we're expecting if major pushes are made, it could drop to between 100 and 50, I mean, okay, so 100 or down to 50 dollars by 2014 per unit of combined battery plus solar. In order to do this, to get that initial mass market build up or move towards that, we've thought of partnering potentially with international organizations, militaries around the world, UNHCR, Red Cross, Red Crescent, and any active military has a need for tents. And anytime there's a tent, there's got to be power. They need diesel. It costs a lot of money. And this is the kind of thing that could provide a huge advantage to those organizations in their humanitarian and other work, and also bring that price point down so we could go to civil society and say, we have something that is ready to go. We have it at the price you need. And already, of course, governments are, such as the Canadian International Development Agency, DFID, USAID, Germany's GIZ, they're already working on these energy poverty things. What we're trying to do is provide them with a new avenue, a new impetus, and more or less, we're asking, or we're telling you, we are creating this action plan. Will you be a part of it? I hope so. Let's talk afterwards. Thank you very much.
Aaron and Kathy, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, you've now heard some of the tremendous technology-enabled pathways that we've talked about at this summit in order to begin bringing our vision of a low-carbon future to reality through the development of this low-carbon electricity ecosystem. You've also heard something else. As opposed to a lot of summits and conferences that produce statements of you should, other organizations should, you've heard a lot of statements of we will. A lot of the tremendous energy that was brought by the forum and the quorum together to begin to take some of these steps and mobilize some action as steps forwards from here. It's been a tremendous opportunity and a privilege to be part of these tremendous groups. So with that, Wilson, over to you.
Thank you, Jason. It has been an extraordinary week, as you can see. We really feel we've attacked that problem. And what about that original graph you showed up there, Jatin? Would these solutions together really address them?
I am absolutely confident. We have painted a picture for you, a comprehensive, integrated view of our energy future. And we've focused on what science and technology can do to help reboot this conversation around how we decarbonize the global energy system. So, it's my hope, wish, desire, expectation that you will remain engaged with this conversation that we have initiated in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, under the Waterloo Global Science Initiative. Your commitment to becoming the change agents is what we need. Our forum participants, the next generation of leaders, have already adopted to become those change agents. Thank you.
Thank you, Jatin. Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Quorum, advisors, and forum. What a fantastic job. Over to you, John and Julie.
Thank you, Wilson. Ladies and gentlemen, this has truly been a fascinating week of ideas and pathways to a cleaner and more electrified future. We're delighted to have had the opportunity to share some of these tangible technical approaches and implementation steps with you today. These will be fleshed out in more detail over the next few months and then made available via the Equinox Blueprint. This is the document that we will be producing early fall, and we encourage you all to follow along with our progress.
The rollout of today's highlights and the much richer blueprint begins almost immediately. In fact, this month we'll be beginning presentations, starting with the World Federation of Science Journalists at their gathering in Doha, as well as the Canadian Science Writers Association out west also this month. And in addition, we'll be attending international events in the year ahead where science and technology leaders, knowledge leaders, thought leaders in the energy space all gather. So you'll be hearing much more about WGSI in your travels around the world. You'll also be hearing from many of the Quorum, Forum, and advisors who've had just an excellent and highly engaged time this week, who would like to take our materials back with them as they go about their talks at their universities and elsewhere at home. In addition, the WGSI website will remain a living website with all the videos and the content from the summit, and it will be regularly updated with news from around the world on decisions, on investments, on policy, on technological advancements that tie directly to the themes and the ideas that you've heard at this summit. So there's much more to come.
And now, to close the Equinox Summit, please welcome back the Chair of the Waterloo Global Science Initiative and Director of Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, Dr. Neil Turok, and WGSI Vice Chair and the President and Vice Chancellor of the University of Waterloo, Dr. Ferdin Hamdaloper.
Thanks very much, Julie and John. It's been a great pleasure to host you all here at this summit, Energy 2030. And I think the summit has been a huge success. Its goal to reboot the global conversation on energy in 3 days was extremely ambitious. Its format was novel, bringing young leaders, experts, and senior advisors together. And what we've seen is that differences faded away quickly. And I hope that this institute, focused on theoretical physics, fundamental description of nature, is the kind of environment where objectivity and our search for knowledge overcome political or other differences which divide us. And I think this summit really lived up to that. Over this very short time, a credible, big picture strategy has resulted, containing lots of exciting ideas. A huge amount remains to be done, and it's up to all of us to participate, whether by pursuing entirely new scientific discoveries, as we try to do here in this institute, or by engineering new technologies, by establishing new systems, smart grids, by persuading governments and companies to invest in them. We all have a lot of work to do, but I think after the summit, we can face the future smiling and with energy. Thank you.
I was in Ottawa 2 days ago meeting some people, and one of whom was a senior person in the Prime Minister's office, and WGSI was one of the topics we talked about, but he kept referring to it as World Global Science Initiative. After a while, he realized that was Waterloo Global Science Initiative, and I reminded him that it didn't matter, Waterloo or that. And ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the University of Waterloo and our colleagues here at the Perimeter Institute, let me tell you what a great honor it's been to help foster your work here at the Equinox Summit. The past few days, we heard tremendous amount of information and insight in some of our challenges and solutions. And we look forward to continuing collaboration as the Equinox Blueprint is written and then rolled out in the next few months. My gratitude, thanks to the scientists, engineers, the advisors, and the leaders of tomorrow. Thank you for your time, your efforts, and your thoughtful outcomes that have given the Waterloo Global Science Initiative and its inaugural Equinox Summit off to such an outstanding start. WGSI was founded on the belief that our two institutions, the Perimeter Institute and the University of Waterloo, are in a unique and responsible position to collaborate on some of the most central issues facing humankind. Together, and with your collaboration and participation, our vision has been to identify these global issues and leverage both science and cooperative dialogue to contribute to global understanding and commit to concrete action. It is that commitment to action that has been at the core of our being at the University of Waterloo since our founding more than 50 years ago. Our mission has always been tied to make an impact with real societal relevance, and in doing so, building a brighter future for Canada and the world. So while this is the end of the first Equinox Summit, it is just the beginning of the impact of the Waterloo Global Science Initiative. I know we will see you soon. We will see you around the world. We will see you at various venues, and we will also see you online, and hopefully in Waterloo in 2 years' time. I thank you very much for your participation, and hope to see you all at the reception. Thank you very much.
As we conclude this final summit event and streaming broadcast, please allow us to thank once again all of the participants, and please stand and be recognized by the audience here today. Wilson De Silva, Jati Natwani, and Jason Blackstock for their excellent guidance this week. Thank you to the Government of Ontario, the Government of Canada, and the staff of the University of Waterloo and the Perimeter Institute.
And particular thanks to two groups who make this all as publicly accessible as it is, beginning with TVO, our presenting media partner. Without their help, this just would not be possible. And they have continuing programs tonight at 8 o'clock and Friday night at 8 o'clock. So the summit isn't over on TVO. You can continue to tune it in these next couple of nights. And a very big thanks to Sean Kiley and Frank Taylor of Tidal Entertainment, longtime key production partners and special event partners here at the Institute. A big hand to Sean, Frank, and TVO, please. So, ladies and gentlemen, it has been a totally energizing week here at the Waterloo Global Science Initiative, and this officially concludes this first Equinox Summit Energy 2030. For those of you online, thank you very much for tuning in all week. We will see you again on demand as the programs continue to roll out. For those of you on site here in Waterloo, please join us on the main floor for a reception just outside the theater. Thanks again very much. And the proceedings are now concluded.
You made it. Well done.
If I could have your attention for one more minute, please. I know you're rushing to go to the